Section 9 of The Diary of a Provincial Lady by E. M. Delafield. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. June 23rd. Tennis party at wealthy and elaborate house, to which Robert and I now bidden for the first time, also probably the last. Immense opulence of host and hostess at once discernible in fabulous display of deck chairs, all of complete stability and miraculous cleanliness. Am introduced to youngish lady in yellow and serious young man with horn-rimmed spectacles. Lady in yellow says at once that she is sure I have a lovely garden. Why? Elderly but efficient-looking partner is assigned to me, and we play against the horn-rimmed spectacles and agile young creature in expensive crepe de chine. Realize at once that all three play very much better tennis than I do. Still worse, realize that they realize this. Just as we begin, my partner observes gravely that he ought to tell me he is a left-handed player. Cannot imagine what he expects me to do about it, lose my head, and reply madly that that is splendid. Game proceeds. I serve several double faults, and elderly partner becomes graver and graver. At beginning of each game he looks at me and repeats score with fearful distinctness, which, as it is never in our favour, entirely unnerves me. At 6-1, we leave the court and silently seek chairs as far removed from one another as possible. Find myself in vicinity of our member, and we talk about the mace, peeresses in the House of Lords, on which we differ, winter sports and Alsatian dogs. Robert plays tennis and does well. Later on, am again bidden to the court, and, to my unspeakable horror, told to play once more with elderly and efficient partner. I apologize to him for this misfortune, and he inquires in return, with extreme pessimism, 50 years from now, what will it matter if we have lost this game? Neighbouring lady, probably his wife, looks agitated at this, and supplements it by incoherent assurances about its being a great pleasure in any case. Am well aware that she is lying, but intention evidently very kind, for which I feel grateful. Play worse than ever, and am not unprepared for subsequent inquiry from hostess as to whether I think I have really quite got over the measles, as she has heard that it often takes a full year. I reply humorously that, so far as tennis goes, it will take far more than a full year. Perceive by expression of civil perplexity on face of hostess that she has entirely failed to grasp this rather subtle witticism, and wish that I hadn't made it. I'm still thinking about this failure when I notice that conversation has, mysteriously, switched on to the United States of America, about which we are all very emphatic. Americans, we say, undoubtedly hospitable, but what about the war debt? What about prohibition? What about Sinclair Lewis, Amy McPherson, and co-education? By the time we have done with them, it transpires that none of us have ever been to America, but all hold definite views, which, fortunately, coincide with the views of everybody else. Query: could not interesting little experiment be tried, by possessor of unusual amount of moral courage, in the shape of suddenly producing perfectly brand new opinion, for example, to the effect that Americans have better manners than we have, or that their divorce laws are a great improvement upon our own? Should much like to see effect of these, or similar psychological bombs, but should definitely wish Robert to be absent from the scene. Announcement of tea breaks off these intelligent speculations. Am struck, as usual, by infinite superiority of other people's food to my own. Conversation turns upon Lady B, and everyone says she is really very kind-hearted, and follows this up by anecdotes illustrating all her less attractive qualities. Youngish lady in yellow declares that she met Lady B last week in London, face 3 inches thick in new sunburn tan. can quite believe it. Feel much more at home after this, and conscious of new bond of union cementing entire party. Sidelight thus thrown upon human nature regrettable, but not to be denied. Even tennis improves after this, entirely owing to my having told funny story relating to Lady B's singular behaviour in regard to local jumble sale, which meets with success. Serve fewer double faults, but still cannot quite escape conviction that whoever plays with me invariably loses the set, which I cannot believe to be mere coincidence. Suggest to Robert, on the way home, that I had better give up tennis altogether, to which, after long silence, during which I hope he is perhaps evolving short speech that shall be at once complimentary and yet convincing, he replies that he does not know what I could take up instead. As I do not know either, the subject is dropped, and we return home in silence. June 27th. Cook says that unless I am willing to let her have the sweep, she cannot possibly be responsible for the stove. I say that, of course, she can have the sweep. If not, Cook returns, totally disregarding this, she really can't say what won't happen. I reiterate my complete readiness to send the sweep a summons on the instant, and Cook continues to look away from me and to repeat that unless I will agree to having the sweep in, there's no knowing. This dialogue, cannot say why, upsets me for the remainder of the day. June 30th. The sweep comes and devastates the entire day. Bathwater and meals are alike cold, and soot appears quite irrelevantly in portions of the house totally removed from sphere of sweep's activities. Am called upon in the middle of the day to produce 12 and 6 pence in cash, which I cannot do. Appeal to everybody in the house and find that nobody else can either. Finally, Cook announces that the joint has just come and can oblige at the back door if I don't mind its going down in the book. I do not, and the sweep is accordingly paid and disappears on a motor bicycle. July 3rd. Breakfast enlivened by letter from dear Rose, written at, apparently, earthly paradise of blue sea and red rocks, on south coast of France. She says that she is having complete rest, and enjoying congenial society of charming group of friends, and makes unprecedented suggestion that I should join her for a fortnight. I am moved to exclaim, perhaps rather thoughtlessly, that the most wonderful thing in the world must be to be a childless widow. But this is met by unsympathetic silence from Robert, which recalls me to myself and impels me to say that that isn't in the least what I meant. Memo. Should often be very, very sorry to explain exactly what it is that I do mean, and am in fact conscious of deliberately avoiding self-analysis on many occasions. Do not propose, however, to go into this now or at any other time. I tell Robert that if it wasn't for the expense, and not having any clothes, and the servants, and leaving Vicky, I should think seriously of Rose's suggestion. Why, I inquire rhetorically, should Lady B have a monopoly of the south of France? Robert replies, "Well," and pauses for such a while that I get agitated and have mentally gone through the divorce court with him, before he ends up by saying, "Well," again, and picking up the Western Morning News. Feel, but do not say, that this, as contribution to discussion, is inadequate. Am prepared, however, to continue it single-handed sooner than allow subject to drop altogether. Do so, but am interrupted first by entrance of Helen Wills through the window. Robert says, "Damn that cat, I shall have it drowned," but only absent-mindedly. And then by spirit-lamp, which is discovered to be extinct and to require new wick. Robert strongly in favour of ringing immediately, but I discourage this, and undertake to speak about it instead, and tie knot in pocket-handkerchief. Unfortunately, overcharged memory fails later when in kitchen, and find myself unable to recollect whether marmalade has run to sugar through remaining too long in jar, or merely porridge lumpier than usual, but this a digression. I read Rose's letter all over again, and feel that I have here opportunity of a lifetime. Suddenly hear myself exclaiming passionately that travel broadens the mind, and am immediately reminded of our vicar's wife, who frequently makes similar remark, before taking our vicar to spend fortnight's holiday in North Wales. Robert finally says, well, again, this time tone of voice slightly more lenient, and then asks if it is quite impossible for his bottle of Eno's to be left undisturbed on bathroom shelf. I at once and severely condemn Mademoiselle as undoubted culprit, although guiltily aware that original suggestion probably emanated from myself. And what, I add, about the south of France? Robert looks astounded, and soon afterwards leaves the dining-room without having spoken. I deal with my correspondence, omitting Rose's letter. Remainder boils down to rather uninspiring collection of accounts rendered, offensive little pamphlet that makes a searching inquiry into the state of my gums, postcard from County Secretary of Women's Institutes, with notice of meeting that I am expected to attend, and warmly worded personal communication addressed me by name from unknown titled gentleman, which ends up with a request for 5 shillings if I cannot spare more, in aid of charity in which he is interested. Whole question of south of France is shelved until evening, when I seek Mademoiselle in schoolroom after Vicky has gone to bed. I am horrified to see that supper, awaiting her on the table, consists of cheese, pickles, and slice of jam roly-poly, grouped on single plate. Would not this suggest to the artistic mind a still-life study in modern art, flanked by colossal jug of cold water? Is this, I ask, what Mademoiselle likes? She assures me that it is, and adds austerely that food is of no importance to her. She could go without anything for days and days, without noticing it. From her early childhood she has always been the same. Query unavoidably suggests itself here. Does Mademoiselle really expect me to believe her, and if so, what can be her opinion of my mental capacity? We discuss Vicky. Tendency to argumentativeness, I hint. C'est un petit cœur d'or, returns Mademoiselle immediately. I agree in modified terms, and Mademoiselle at once points out dear Vicky's undeniable obstinacy and self-will, and goes so far as to say, plus tard, ce sera un esprit fort, elle ira loin, cette petite. I bring up the subject of the south of France. Mademoiselle, more than sympathetic, assures me that I must at all costs go, adding, a little unnecessarily, that I have grown many, many years older in the last few months, and that to live as I do, without any distractions, only leads to madness in the end. Feel that she could hardly have worded this more trenchantly, and am a good deal impressed. Query. Would Robert see the force of these representations or not? Robert apt to take rather prejudiced view of all that is not purely English. Return to drawing-room and find Robert asleep behind the Times. Read Rose's letter all over again, and am moved to make list of clothes that I should require if I joined her, estimate of expenses, financial situation, though not scintillating, still considerably brighter than usual, owing to recent legacy, and even notes, on back of envelope, of instructions to be given to Mademoiselle, cook, and the tradespeople before leaving. July 6th. Decide definitely on joining Rose at St. Agathe, and write and tell her so. Die now cast and Rubicon crossed, or rather will be, on achieving further side of the channel. Robert, on the whole, takes lenient view of entire project, and says he supposes that nothing else will satisfy me, and better not count on really hot weather promised by Rose, but take good supply of woollen underwear. Mademoiselle is sympathetic but theatrical, and exclaims, C'est la Sainte Vierge qui a tout arrangé, which sounds like a travel agency and shocks me. Go to Women's Institute meeting and tell our secretary that I am afraid I shall have to miss our next committee meeting. She immediately replies that the date can easily be altered. I protest, but am defeated by small calendar, which she at once produces, and begs me to select my own date, and says that it will be all the same to the 11 other members of the committee. Have occasional misgivings at a recollection of rousing speeches made by various speakers from our National Federation, to the effect that all WI members enjoy equal responsibilities and equal privileges. Can only hope that none of them will ever have occasion to enter more fully into the inner workings of our monthly committee meetings. July 12th. Pay farewell calls and receive much good advice. Our vicar says that it is madness to drink water anywhere in France unless previously boiled and filtered. Our vicar's wife shares Robert's distrust as to climate and advises Jaeger next the skin, and also offers loan of small travelling medicine chest for emergencies. Discussion follows as to whether bisulfate of quinine is, or is not, dutiable article, and is finally brought to inconclusive conclusion by our vicar's pronouncing definitely that, in any case, honesty is the best policy. Old Mrs. Blenkinsop, whom I reluctantly visit whenever I get a letter from Barbara saying how grateful she is for my kindness, adopts quavering and enfeebled manner, and hopes she may be here to welcome me home again on my return, but implies that this is not really to be anticipated. I say, come, come, and begin well-turned sentence as to Mrs. B.'s wonderful vitality, when Cousin Maud bounces in, and inspiration fails me on the spot. "What ho!" says Cousin Maud, or at least produces the effect of having said it, though possibly slang slightly more up-to-date than this, but not much. "What is all this about our cutting a dash on the Lido or somewhere, and leaving our home to take care of itself? Talk about the emancipation of females," says Cousin Maud. Should like to reply that no one except herself ever does talk about it, but feel this might reasonably be construed as uncivil, and do not want to upset unfortunate old Mrs. B., whom I now regard as a victim, pure and simple. Ignore Cousin Maud, and ask old Mrs. B. what books she would advise me to take. Amount of luggage strictly limited, both as to weight and size, but could manage two very long ones if in pocket editions, and another to be carried in coat pocket for journey. Old Mrs. B., probably still intent on thought of approaching dissolution, suddenly says that there is nothing like the Bible, suggestion which I feel might more properly have been left to our vicar. Naturally, give her to understand that I agree, but do not commit myself further. Cousin Maud, in a positive way that annoys me, recommends no book at all, especially when crossing the sea. It is well known, she affirms, that any attempt to fix the eyes on printed page while ship is moving induces seasickness quicker than anything else. Better repeat poetry, or the multiplication table, as this serves to distract the mind. Have no assurance that the multiplication table is at my command, but do not reveal this to Cousin Maud. Old Mrs. B., abandoning scriptural attitude, now says, give her Shakespeare. Everything is to be found in Shakespeare. Look at King Lear, she says. Cousin Maud assents with customary energy, but should be prepared to take considerable bet that she has never read a word of King Lear since it was, presumably, stuffed down her throat at dear old Rodine, in intervals of cricket and hockey. We touch on literature in general. Old Mrs. B. observes that much that is published nowadays seems to her unnecessary, and why so much sex in everything? Cousin Maud says that books collect dust anyway, and whisks away inoffensive copy of Time and Tide, with which old Mrs. B. is evidently solacing herself in intervals of being hustled in and out of baby Austin, and I take my leave. Am embraced by old Mrs. B., who shows tendency to have one of her old-time attacks, but is briskly headed off it by Cousin Maud, and slapped on the back by Cousin Maud in familiar and extremely offensive manner. Walk home and am overtaken by well-known blue Bentley, from which Lady B waves elegantly and commands chauffeur to stop. He does so, and Lady B says, "Get in, get in, never mind muddy boots," which makes me feel like a ploughboy. Good works, she supposes, have been taking me plodding round the village as usual. The way I go on, day after day, is just too marvellous. Reply with utmost distinctness that I am just on the point of starting for the south of France, where I am joining party of distinguished friends. This not entirely untrue, since dear Rose has promised introduction to many interesting acquaintances, including Viscountess. Really, says Lady B, but why not go at the right time of year? Or why not go all the way by sea, yachting too marvellous? Or why not again make it Scotland instead of France? Do not reply to any of all this, and request to be put down at the corner. This is done, and Lady B waves directions to chauffeur to drive on, but subsequently stops him again, and leans out to say that she can find out all about quite an expensive pension for me, if I like. I do not like, and we part finally. Find myself indulging in rather melodramatic fantasy of Bentley crashing into enormous motorbus and being splintered to atoms. Permit chauffeur to escape unharmed, but fate of Lady B left uncertain, owing to ineradicable impression of earliest childhood, to the effect that it is wicked to wish for the death of another. Do not consider, however, that severe injuries, with possible disfigurement, come under this law. But entire topic unprofitable, and had better be dismissed. July 14th. Question of books to be taken abroad undecided till late hour last night. Robert says, why take any? And Vicky proffers Les Malheurs de Sophie, which she puts into the very bottom of my suitcase, whence it is extracted with some difficulty by Mademoiselle later. Finally decide on Little Dorrit and the Daisy Chain, with Jane Eyre in coat pocket. Should prefer to be the kind of person who is inseparable from volume of Keats, or even Jane Austen, but cannot compass this. July 15th. Memo. Remind Robert before starting that Gladys's wages due on Saturday. Speak about having my room turned out. Speak about laundry. Speak to Mademoiselle about Vicky's teeth, glycothymoline, Helen Will's knot on bed, and lining of tussore coat. Write butcher. Wash hair. July 17th. Robert sees me off by early train for London, after scrambled and agitating departure, exclusively concerned with frantic endeavours to induce suitcase to shut. This is at last accomplished, but leaves me with conviction that it will be at least equally difficult to induce it to open again. Vicky bids me cheerful but affectionate good-bye, and then shatters me at 11th hour by inquiring trustfully if I shall be home in time to read to her after tea. As entire extent of absence has already been explained to her in full, this inquiry merely senseless, but serves to unnerve me badly, especially as Mademoiselle ejaculates, "Ah, le pauvre cher mignon," into the blue. Memo. The French very often carried away by emotionalism to wholly preposterous lengths. Cook, Gladys, and the gardener stand at hall door, and hope that I shall enjoy my holiday, and Cook adds a rider to the effect that it seems to be blowing up for a gale, and for her part she has always had an horror of death by drowning. On this we drive away. Arrive at station too early, as usual, and I fill in time by asking Robert if he will telegraph if anything happens to the children, as I could be back again in 24 hours. He only inquires in return whether I have my passport. Am perfectly aware that passport is in my small purple dressing-case, where I put it a week ago, and have looked at it 2 or 3 times every day ever since, last time just before leaving my room 45 minutes ago. am, nevertheless, mysteriously impelled to open handbag, take out key, unlock small purple dressing-case, and verify presence of passport all over again. Query: is not behaviour of this kind well known in therapeutic circles as symptomatic of mental derangement? Vague but disquieting association here with singular behaviour of Dr. Johnson in London streets, but too painful to be pursued to a finish. Arrival of train, and I say good-bye to Robert, and madly inquire if he would rather I gave up going at all. He rightly ignores this altogether. Query: would not extremely distressing situation arise if similar impulsive offer were one day to be accepted? This gives rise to unavoidable speculation in regard to sincerity of such offers, and, here again, issue too painful to be frankly faced, and am obliged to shelve train of thought altogether. Turn my attention to fellow traveller, distrustful-looking woman with grey hair, who at once informs me that door of lavatory, opening out of compartment, has defective lock and will not stay shut. I say, "Oh," in tone of sympathetic concern, and shut door. It remains shut. We watch it anxiously, and it flies open again. Later on, fellow traveller makes fresh attempt, with similar result. Much of the journey spent in this exercise. I observe thoughtfully that hope springs eternal in the human breast, and fellow traveller looks more distrustful than ever. She finally says in despairing tones that, really, it isn't what she calls very nice, and lapses into depressed silence. Door remains triumphantly open. Drive from Waterloo to Victoria, take out passport in taxi in order to have it ready, then decide safer to put it back again in dressing-case, which I do. Dr. Johnson recrudesces faintly, but is at once dismissed. Observe with horror that trees in Grosvenor Gardens are swaying with extreme violence in stiff gale of wind. Change English money into French at Victoria Station, where superior young gentleman in little kiosk refuses to let me have anything smaller than 100-franc notes. I ask what use that will be when it comes to porters, but superior young gentleman remains adamant. Infinitely competent person in blue and gold, labelled Dean and Dawson, comes to my rescue, miraculously provides me with change, says, "Have I booked a seat?" pilots me to it, and tells me that he represents the best-known travel agency in London. I assure him warmly that I shall never patronise any other, which is true, and we part with mutual esteem. I make note on half of torn luggage label, to the effect that it would be merest honesty to write and congratulate D&D on admirable employee, but feel that I shall probably never do it. Journey to Folkestone entirely occupied in looking out of train window and seeing quite large trees bowed to earth by force of wind. Cook's words recur most unpleasantly. Also recall various forms of advice received, and find it difficult to decide between going instantly to the ladies' saloon, taking off my hat and lying down perfectly flat, Mademoiselle's suggestion, or keeping in the fresh air at all costs and thinking about other things, course advocated on a postcard by Aunt Gertrude. Choice taken out of my hands by discovery that ladies' saloon is entirely filled, within 5 minutes of going on board, by other people, who have all taken off their hats and are lying down perfectly flat. Return to deck, sit on suitcase, and decide to think about other things. Schoolmaster and his wife, who are going to Boulogne for a holiday, talk to one another across me about university extension course, and appear to be superior to the elements. I take out Jane Eyre from coat pocket, partly in faint hope of impressing them, and partly to distract my mind, but remember Cousin Maud, and am forced to conclusion that she may have been right. Perhaps advice equally correct in respect of repeating poetry. Can think of nothing whatever, except extraordinary damp chill which appears to be creeping over me. Schoolmaster suddenly says to me, "Quite all right, aren't you?" To which I reply, "Oh, yes." And he laughs in a bright and scholastic way, and talks about the Matterhorn. Although unaware of any conscious recollection of it, find myself inwardly repeating curious and ingenious example of alliterative verse committed to memory in my school days. Note, can dimly understand why the dying revert to impressions of early infancy. Just as I get to Cossack commanders cannonading come, dealing destruction's devastating doom, elements overcome me altogether. Have dim remembrance of hearing schoolmaster exclaim in authoritative tones to everybody within earshot, "Make way for this lady, she is ill," which injunction he repeats every time I am compelled to leave suitcase. Throughout intervals I continue to grapple, more or less deliriously, with alliterative poem, and do not give up altogether until "Reason returns, religious rites redound," is reached. This I consider creditable. Attain Boulogne at last, discover reserved seat in train, am told by several officials whom I question that we do, or alternatively do not, change when we reach Paris, give up the elucidation of the point for the moment, and demand, and obtain, small glass of brandy, which restores me. End of section 9.